from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Longtime conservative commentator and military historian Max Boot left the GOP the day after Donald Trump was elected and is a sharp critic of the current administration on everything from an overly soft stance on Russia to what he sees as policies that fly in the face of Republican values. We'll talk to Max Boot about his conversion and his new book, The Road Not Taken, which is all about Edward Lansdale, an influential soldier and spy who might have changed the course of the Vietnam War. That's next, after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Edward Lansdale, a name that probably is not familiar to most of you, but a name of a man who was a likely inspiration for the character Colonel Hillendale in Graham Greene's novel The Ugly American. He was an influential soldier and a spy during the Cold War era. It wasn't Graham Greene. Actually, people thought he was a prototype for another Graham Greene novel. We'll get into all that with Max Boot, but let me just begin by saying Max Boot is here with us in studio. He's a military historian. His new book is called The Road Not Taken, and I know many of you recognize that from Robert Frost. It profiles Lansdale, who was a maverick and who believed he knew how the United States could have prevailed in the Vietnam War, thus the title, The Road Not Taken, His Road. He joins us to discuss Lansdale's story and the American tragedy in Vietnam, and we're also going to talk to him about the latest news out of Washington, because Max Boot is a well-known staunch conservative, and yet has been a vocal critic of President Trump, who he says is, quote, redefining American identity in white nationalist terms. Welcome back to Forum, Max Boot.
Delighted to be back, Michael.
Yeah, pleased to have you back. And I should say the last time you were here, you met Mike Tyson, I believe. That was the last time you were here. Mike Tyson said he was thrilled to meet Max Boot because he's an amateur military historian, apparently. We didn't know that. I want to get into the book with you, but let's talk about politics first. Are you still a conservative?
I like to think so. I mean, I hesitate to call myself a conservative anymore because I'm not sure what conservative means anymore. It's become a synonym for follower of Trump, so I actually prefer to call myself a classical liberal.
What do you make out of this, followers of Trump? I mean, let's exempt people who aren't running again, like Jeff Flake, perhaps, or Bob Corker, but 90% of the Republican Party is behind this president as their leader?
It's shocking and dismaying. I would have never imagined this could come to pass. I mean, I'm somebody who never thought that Trump would win a single Republican primary, much less the presidency. And now, of course, he's not only president, but has maintained 90% of Republican support in spite of the shocking tendency with which he caters to racism, misogyny, nativism, all the darkest impulses in America. And he does so openly and consistently shows that he is unfit to be president, and yet Republicans are willing to go along with him.
Well, because of his base and their fear of not being reelected, or because he got tax reform through? How do you read it?
Oh, I think it's a combination of things. I think that there is a base out there that thrills to his racist and nativist rhetoric and actions. He's finally giving them what they want. I think there are others who don't necessarily support him on those grounds but are willing to overlook his shocking appeals to prejudice and his incompetence to be president because they think they will get something out of it, whether it's judges or tax cuts or what have you. And so they rationalize away the fact that he is unfit to be president and try to look the other way. So I think it's a combination of motives, but at the end of the day, it's a shocking abdication of responsibility and one that I think should call the future of the Republican Party into question.
What do you make out of the whole security clearance fiasco that's going on now, especially in light of Rob Porter, who is not only not given a security clearance, but brought up on charges of wife beating and two ex-wives, in fact. There was a restraining order against him, all of these kinds of things. And it took the president a week to actually say something about domestic violence and how it's bad.
This is the kind of thing that would be shocking with any other president. With Donald Trump, it's kind of more of the same. I mean, you don't know whether to laugh or cry, given that you know, part of his campaign rhetoric against Hillary Clinton, you know, lock her up because she was derelict in her handling of classified information, supposedly, on her email system. And now there's over 100 people in the White House who don't have full security clearances, including Jared Kushner, who have access to some of our most nation's most sensitive secrets. I mean, this is makes a mockery of everything that Republicans have been saying. And it once again exposes the boundless hypocrisy of Donald Trump and his acolytes.
Well, one of his acolytes is Devin Nunes, and you said he should be brought up on charges?
Well, this is just so shameful and disgusting. Republicans for decades have postured as the law and order party, and Donald Trump himself talks about how he supposedly loves cops and stands up for them. But in the meantime, Trump and his minions, including Devin Nunes, are mounting the most shameful assault on the FBI and the Justice Department. And what they're really assaulting is the rule of law, because in their view, Donald Trump should not be investigated by Robert Mueller. He should not be investigated by the FBI. He should be above the law. I've never seen anything like this. I think this goes beyond even what Richard Nixon did in subverting the legal system. I mean, this is Donald Trump is attempting to obstruct justice, and people like Devin Nunes are his willful accomplices.
Well, he said that as President Trump said, that memo that was released by Nunes has vindicated him from the Mueller investigation. And, I mean, that's an extraordinary statement in itself, but I'm just wondering.
And like much of what Trump says, it has zero foundation in fact.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But also, David K. Johnson was on with us yesterday, and he was intimating that maybe Trump is an agent of the Kremlin. Now, you've been very critical of Trump, but would you go that far as to intimate that he's actually working for Putin? He's never criticized Putin. He's certainly been in every way almost supportive of Putin and the Russians.
Well, I don't know that he's necessarily working for Putin, but I think there is a suspicious relationship between Trump and Putin, and that's why we need the Robert Mueller investigation to figure out what's going on. I mean, it is striking that Trump has negative words for pretty much everybody, you know, in the universe, from Katie Turr to Jay-Z, and never has a negative word to say about Vladimir Putin, and by all indications actually greatly admires him. So we don't know if this is simply that he loves strongmen or whether there are deeper linkages having to do with finances or other matters, perhaps some of the blackmail material spelled out in the Christopher Steele dossier. We just don't know. That's why we need Robert Mueller to get to the bottom of this, and why it's so suspicious that Trump is doing everything he possibly can to obstruct the Mueller investigation. He certainly looks like a man with a lot to hide.
We're talking to Max Boot. He's here with us in studio. He's senior fellow for national security studies now with the Council on Foreign Relations, author of a book called The Road Not Taken, Edward Lansdale and the American Tragedy in Vietnam, which we are going to get to. But your conservative positions have always been very, in many ways, pro-military. I presume that at least on that score, you're still pretty much on board. What about all this increased spending? And I mean, the traditional role of the Republican Party was to be fiscal hawks and, you know, not bankrupt us in terms of our next generation. But, you know, we're going into numbers that never could have been imagined even.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in favor of defense spending, but I'm also in favor of fiscal responsibility. And the Republican Party has utterly abdicated that plank, which it has stood for so long. As a result of their tax cut, we're going to see an added $1 trillion in debt. Now they've passed a stimulus spending bill of over $500 billion that will add more to the debt, such that very soon we're going to have $1 trillion deficits as far as the eye can see. This is not a sustainable course. I mean, in one of my columns, I joke that MAGA must stand for Make America Greece and On, because that is the way that we are headed. And anybody who imagines that we're going to be able to continue funding defense at the current levels, if we're being swallowed up in a sea of red ink, is just smoking something. It's not going to happen. This is going to cripple our finances, and it's going to, at the end of the day, also cripple our military capacity.
Well, let's talk about your book in this context, because we're continuing to spend a great deal of money and lifeblood in places like Afghanistan, particularly Afghanistan, a war that's been going on for 17 years. And there's a lesson to be learned from, I mean, as far as you're concerned, from Edward Lansdale, who was, let me get this on record, the fictional model for Graham Greene's The Quiet American, so it's alleged, but I think the chronology doesn't work out there. And the fact of the matter is, he was a guy who said, and he did it successfully in the Philippines, hearts and minds, rather than what was done in Vietnam, which was kill tolls and more use of weaponry and so forth, military actions. How does this apply today? Well, I mean, getting to Lansdale himself, but, you know, how do you see this applying, for example, in Afghanistan? How could we tried to cozy up to Karzai, that didn't work, and he was corrupt. How can we find a leader like, for example, Lansdale found in the Philippines and Afghanistan?
Well, we didn't really cozy up to Karzai. And in fact, one of the biggest problems we've had in places like Iraq and Afghanistan is that we got into these very confrontational relationships with our own local allies, whether it was Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan or Nouri al-Maliki in Iraq. What we really needed was somebody like Ed Lansdale who could manage these foreign leaders in the same way that he managed Ramon Magsaysay, became a very close friend of Ramon Magsaysay, the defense minister of the Philippines, and helped to make him president in 1953, and by so doing, masterminded the defeat of a communist insurgency. And then in 1954, Lansdale went to South Vietnam and befriended Ngo Dinh Diem, the newly appointed prime minister of South Vietnam, became very close to him, and again, masterminded his consolidation of power from 1954 to 1956. But tragically, by the early 1960s, Lansdale was back in Washington, and there was no American who was close to Diem and who could advise him in a constructive and fruitful manner. And so as a result of that, he got into a very destructive confrontation in 1963 with militant Buddhists, and eventually the Kennedy administration backed a military coup against Diem, something that Lansdale had warned against. We didn't overthrow Karzai, we didn't overthrow Maliki, but I see some of those same dysfunctional dynamics in place because we don't have somebody like an Ed Lansdale who can deal with these foreign leaders today from a position of friendship and trust and empathy and gently guide them along instead of issuing these counterproductive demands that we tend to issue from Washington that often backfire.
You've kind of made him into sort of a T.E. Lawrence of Asia in some ways, haven't you?
Well, that was one of his many nicknames. He was, among other things, known as the American James Bond and the T.E. Lawrence of Asia, the ugly American, the quiet American. He was actually very similar to T.E. Lawrence in that he was somebody who had an extraordinary ability to bond with foreigners and to win their trust and to become a very valuable advisor to them. But like T. Lawrence, he was ultimately frustrated by the machinations of his own government. And, you know, T. Lawrence felt betrayed after World War One because instead of granting freedom to the Middle East, French and British colonialists divided up the Middle East between them. And Lansdale felt very much betrayed because the Kennedy administration overthrew and killed his friend Ngo Dinh Diem and then embarked on this costly, horrific conventional war in Vietnam that he advised against. Because Lansdale was somebody who wanted to protect South Vietnam, but he thought that South Vietnamese needed to take the lead in their own defense and that we should provide advisors and support, but we should not Americanize the war. And he consistently argued against the illusion that people like General William Westmoreland had that they could kill their way out of this insurgency. But Lansdale was not listened to. And so, like T. Lawrence, he ended his days with a haunting sense of failure.
Now, you bring Westmoreland into sharp relief in terms of his culpability. What about people like McNamara? What about people in the Kennedy administration?
Oh, they were all very culpable. And in the book, I describe some memorable confrontations that Ed Lansdale had with Robert McNamara, who was, you know, one of the best and brightest former chairman of the Ford Motor Company, somebody who thought that numbers held the key to existence. And Lansdale was not so academically bright. He had dropped out of UCLA, but he had spent years in Southeast Asia, and so he tried to begin educating Robert McNamara in the kind of war that he would face. In early 1961, Lansdale was just back from Vietnam and brought with him some captured Viet Cong weapons, some very simple rifles and pistols, all caked in mud and blood, and dumped them on McNamara's immaculate desk. And he said, "Mr. Secretary, these are the weapons that are being used by our enemies in Vietnam. They're not very sophisticated, and the people who are using them, you wouldn't even recognize them as soldiers. They wear black pajamas and rubber sandals, and yet they're licking the troops on our side because they have something that our South Vietnamese don't, which is the power of an idea, the power of an ideal. And the only way we're going to defeat the Viet Cong is by offering the South Vietnamese the power of a more powerful ideal. We're not going to bomb this revolution into oblivion." Now, in hindsight, that sounds like pretty good advice, but McNamara was invincibly armored in his ignorance and arrogance and refused to listen. And that was the tragedy of Ed Lansdale.
And thus the road not taken. Of course, could he have really won those hearts and minds in a way that he did in the Philippines? I mean, that's at this point just hypothetical, really.
Well, of course, like all counterfactuals, you can't prove it. And I think after the overthrow and murder of Ngo Dinh Diem in 1963, which I think was a pivotal turning point, it became very, very difficult to implement the Lansdale approach. And I certainly can't sit here and tell you that if Lansdale had been listened to, everything would have worked out wonderfully and South Vietnam would have survived. We might very well have lost the war anyway, because North Vietnam is going to be a formidable adversary under any circumstances with more will to win than we had. But of one thing I am pretty certain, which is that if Ed Lansdale had been listened to, we would not have lost 58,000 Americans in Vietnam. We would not have had millions of Vietnamese killed in the crossfire, because he never wanted to see 500,000 American troops thrashing around the jungles of Vietnam to begin with.
Talking again with Max Boot, Senior Fellow for National Security Studies with the Council on Foreign Relations. His book is called The Road Not Taken, Edward Lansdale and the American Tragedy in Vietnam. And just for the record, it was Eugene Burdick and William Lederer who wrote The Ugly American, which also was made into a movie. Lansdale is a fascinating figure in so many ways. I mean, he was a frat boy. He was an advertising executive. You know, how does somebody like that wind up a counterinsurgency expert and a spook for the CIA?
Very unusual background, which is what gave him very unusual insights that were not shared by more conventional generals. Because, in fact, as you mentioned, he grew up in L.A. He was an advertising man in San Francisco before World War II. Then he got into the OSS and eventually got into the Army and then the Air Force and worked for the CIA in the Philippines and Vietnam. And so he did not approach war from this conventional mindset. If so many of the generals that we sent to Vietnam were World War II or Korea veterans, and they thought of war in terms of massive firepower and annihilating the enemy armies, and that wasn't the way Lansdale thought about it, because he thought about war as an ad man, as he thought about psychology and politics. And his way of thinking about it was actually made a lot more sense when you were fighting guerrillas and insurgents rather than a conventional military force. But Lansdale had a lot of trouble getting very conventional generals like William Westmoreland to pay attention to what he had to say, because it was so much at odds with their training and background.
But it's funny how immediately coming to my mind in hearing you say that about Lansdale is somebody like Haldeman or Ehrlichman. They were PR guys too, and they were Californians as well, worked with Nixon and just furthered the war efforts with Vietnam until there was going to be peace with honor, which we never quite established.
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say that every Californian had better ideas or every ad man had better ideas, but I think
Lansdale's a visionary, really, don't you?
I think he was in some ways a visionary. I mean, he wasn't right about everything. He got some things wrong and he messed some things up. But, you know, too often he's been caricatured as kind of this simplistic American who didn't know any better. And it's funny, I had a conversation with Daniel Ellsberg, the Pentagon Papers leaker, who worked for Lansdale, got to start working for Lansdale in Vietnam in 1965. And what Dan Ellsberg told me is that he loved Lansdale, but Lansdale came across sometimes as being very simplistic in his public utterances. But in private, he was a much more realistic and cold-eyed student of the conflict. And he actually knew a lot. He knew the local situation. So he was a much more realistic analyst of the situation than the Johnson administration or Westmoreland or these others. And I don't think he's gotten the credit that he's deserved.
Yeah, we just had Daniel Ellsberg on, in fact, on the program here just a few weeks ago. But Lansdale was really kind of he worked for Wild Bill Donovan. That was sort of a catalyst in many ways for his whole career, wasn't it?
He got his start working for the OSS, of course, led by Wild Bill Donovan in World War II. And what I suggest in the book is that he inherited or adopted some characteristics from Wild Bill Donovan, who was this outsized, very unconventional, anti-bureaucratic character who had a tendency for picking bureaucratic fights with enemies like J. Edgar Hoover that ultimately proved to be counterproductive, but also had, was very much of a free thinker, was not stuck in a conventional mindset. And so I think Lansdale mirrored a lot of those characteristics for both good and ill.
You also write a good deal about Lansdale's love life, which is...
I do. This is one of the most fascinating aspects of the book for me. He had this long love affair with this Filipino woman named Pat Kelly, whom he met when he went to the Philippines in 1945, who was incredibly important to him, not only personally, but also professionally, because she really introduced him to Filipino society, introduced him to many of the communist insurgents in the Philippines, and eventually, many decades later, she would become his second wife. But this was a very hidden relationship that others didn't know about, and I only found out about because I tracked down Pat Kelly's granddaughter, who's living in Northern Virginia, and she said, "Would you be interested in these letters in my basement?" And I said, "Boy, would I," because this is the secret love letters of Ed Lansdale and Pat Kelly. And I also had access, by the way, to the letters that Ed Lansdale wrote to his wife, Helen, often simultaneously with the ones that he was writing to his mistress, Pat Kelly. And so this allows me this unprecedented entree into Lansdale's innermost thinking that other authors haven't had. And it enables me to tell not only the military history side of his story, but also the romance, which I didn't expect at all.
And we should say that Lansdale actually retired as a major general?
He did. He was a two-star general, forcibly retired by Robert McNamara in 1963, ironically on the very day that the military coup against Ngo-Dinh Diem was launched, something that he had long advised against.
Max Boot is here with us. He's our guest this hour. He's Senior Fellow for National Security Studies with the Council on Foreign Relations. His book, again, is called The Road Not Taken, Edward Lansdale and the American Tragedy in Vietnam. He'll be at the Commonwealth Club today at 6:30, and we do want to hear from you, so let me tell you how you can join the program if you have questions or comments for our guest, Max Boot, or if you have some thoughts and reflections about what we've been talking about, please feel free to join the program. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Again, you can join us now at 866-733-6786, or you can join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. So what's the lesson today, Max? I mean, particularly when we look back, and you as a military historian look back at Lansdale, especially in light of the fact that, you know, the war is continuing to be waged in Afghanistan. The Taliban continue to present a formidable foe, to put it mildly. I mean, is there a lesson there that we can actually, if the Trump administration were so disposed, could apply?
Well, I think the big lesson of Ed Lansdale is that it's all about the politics, that the way you win counterinsurgencies is not through firepower. It's not by killing insurgents. It's by offering a better alternative. It's by trying to stand up a government that will win the support of its people and that will not be too corrupt or ineffective. And that's really the problem that we faced in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. We've killed a lot of insurgents, but we haven't really had much luck in trying to stand up governments that would win the support of the people. And that's something that Lansdale was also very frustrated by in Vietnam in the 1960s, where he tried to decrease the corruption and increase the effectiveness of the South Vietnamese government. And people like William Westmoreland and Lyndon Johnson just weren't interested because they thought they could just kill their way to victory. And likewise today, I think there's some of that illusion today. And I think that we need to learn from Ed Lansdale's experience that unless you offer a positive alternative, you're ultimately not going to prevail.
Steve Cole was on with us earlier this week as a guest, sitting where you're sitting in the second hour of the program, and he was saying that there were so many mistakes, not only by the United States government, but by the Afghan government with respect to Afghanistan, and by international policies, and of course by the Soviets, because they were the first occupiers before, that is, they preceded us in Afghanistan. You pretty much share that vision of things, I mean, in terms of, again, culpability?
Oh, of course. I mean, there's been one mistake after another. But I think one of our primary mistakes in Afghanistan has been taking a short-term mindset of just killing insurgents instead of trying to build up a positive and stable government to win the support of the people.
But Steve was also arguing that we have created this jihadi disaster that we see, and we and other involvements in Afghanistan have created that the jihadi movement would not have been as strong as had it not been for the mistakes of the United States and allies.
Well, I think we've contributed to the mess. I don't know that we created it, but we've contributed to it.
Again, we're talking to Max Boot. He'll be at the Commonwealth Club this evening, 6:30, and you can join us. Toll-free number, again, is 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Max Boot. He's here with us in studio, and he's now a columnist for The Washington Post. Let's remind you of that. He's working for Jeff Bezos now. He's also a senior fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations, working for Richard Haass, and author of The Road Not Taken, working very much for himself, Edward Lansdale and the American Tragedy in Vietnam. Again, remind you, he'll be at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco today at 6:30, and also remind you that we do welcome your involvement in the program. You can join the conversation by coming to us by phone, 866-733-6786, or by email, forum@kqed.org. And here's an email from a listener who wants to know, this put on your military historian hat, Max, can we be at war with a country that isn't shooting at us? That is cyber war just a metaphor, or is it for real?
Well, that's a great question. That's something we need to figure out because, You know, with cyber war, I would say we are approximately in the same place today as we were with aerial warfare in, let's say, 1912. We're really at the dawn of this new age of warfare, and you're seeing a lot of attacks occur not only in cyberspace, but also just in the information realm generally. You're seeing the use of little green men by the Russians in places like Ukraine, hybrid warfare, asymmetric warfare. There's a lot of terms that are floating around, but this is of great concern and should be of great concern, because these kinds of techniques negate a lot of our conventional military superiority. I mean, if you think about what happened in the 2016 elections, this was arguably the most effective attack on America since 9/11, when Putin figured out how to subvert our electoral process. And there's not a thing that all of our F-16s and M-16s and all the rest of it can do about it, right?
It's also stunning that now Mike Pence has come out and said, you know, we were probably invaded by the Russians in terms of cyber warfare and affecting our elections. He's gone along with the intelligence agencies, but not from President Trump.
Yeah, very mysterious. Trump won't even acknowledge what happened, which suggests that he has some consciousness of guilt.
Got a question from a listener, Mitch, on Lansdale in Cuba, which you write about in the book. Mitch, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I just reading about the early history of ARPA, and my understanding that Lansdale was pulled out of Vietnam to help with the Bay of Pigs invasion. Is that true?
Not exactly. He was not in Vietnam at the time of the Bay of Pigs. That was in 1961. He was in the Pentagon, and he actually opposed the Bay of Pigs operation. But what happened afterwards was that the Kennedys still wanted to overthrow Castro, but they no longer trusted the CIA, which had run the Bay of Pigs disaster. And so they turned to Ed Lansdale, who at that time was a senior official at the Pentagon. And at the end of 1961, he was appointed operations director of Operation Mongoose to overthrow Fidel Castro. And he very quickly figured out the only way you were going to overthrow Castro was with an American military invasion. But the Kennedys didn't want to send troops into Cuba. What they wanted was some kind of covert action gimmick that would enable them to overthrow Castro at scant cost to themselves. And so Lansdale spent much of 1962 in a fruitless search for this kind of covert action miracle that could get rid of Castro, which did not exist. And then the only thing that Operation Mongoose really produced that was useful was it produced the intelligence which enabled policymakers in Washington to learn that Nikita Khrushchev was putting nuclear missiles into Cuba. But then after the Cuban Missile Crisis, it was disbanded. And that was the end of Ed Lansdale's involvement in Cuba, which he subsequently regretted.
Mitch, let me go back to you for a minute. Did that answer your question?
It did. I was just curious if Max could comment any more on the. I understand that Goodell or Godel was one of the lieutenants of the CIA through his involvement in ARPA in their early years in Vietnam. I was wondering if the two overlapped at all, or.
I mean, I'm not familiar with who that is. I mean, if you're talking about ARPA, you're talking about what became known as DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Agency, which was involved in trying to find technical means to enhance U.S. military capabilities. And Lansdale was never very interested in technology because he always said that this was a people's war and that the way you win is by winning over the people. And he consistently warned generals and policymakers that there was no kind of firepower or technological gimmick that was going to enable you to defeat the Viet Cong.
Let me thank the caller. A listener who writes, in Harry Summers on strategy, he says that we should have defended South Vietnam borders only and stayed out of the country itself. How does Mr. Boot's analysis compare with Summers and Lansdale's?
Well, Harry Summers was very much the conventional big army mindset, where he thought that the only problem with the way the Vietnam War was waged was that we didn't use enough firepower, we didn't invade North Vietnam, we didn't, you know, make the war even bigger. And that was the opposite of what Lansdale believed, and I have to agree with Lansdale, because in fact we dropped more bombs in Vietnam than we had in World War II, and even if we had invaded North Vietnam, that doesn't mean we would have won, because remember, the French controlled ostensibly all of Indochina, and they still lost to the Viet Minh because they had cross-border support from China. That wouldn't have changed, and an invasion of North Vietnam, as people like Harry Summers advocated, could have resulted in another Korean War with the Chinese coming in. And so I'm very skeptical of that Harry Summers mindset, saying that, you know, kind of this was the standard right-wing critique of the war, that we fought with one hand tied behind our back. I don't think that's really accurate. I think there's more truth in the Ed Lansdale critique, which was that we used so much firepower and disrupted South Vietnamese society so much that we created more enemies than we eliminated, and it was just not a fruitful way to wage war.
3 million Vietnamese, actually, I mean, in terms of most of the counts that we see, and 58,000 U.S. Americans.
Right. Terrible tragedy that might have been avoided if people had listened to Ed Lansdale.
Well, let's listen to another caller. Let me bring Bernard in as next caller. Bernard, you're on the air.
Yes, very, very interesting talk. I wanted to ask specifically the guest when he's saying win the will of the people. I agree with that. I mean, bombing into oblivion has never worked. But to me, that sounds like a code word for nation building. And the United States is not in the mood or tolerant for nation building. We're lowering taxes and, you know, infrastructure is falling apart. So if specifically we're not going to do any nation building, we tried in Iraq, billions were wasted, then the other alternative would be bombing to oblivion, which doesn't work, or forming coalitions with other nations to help solve problems. But the United States has always had the premise, we need to take the lead. So I wanted to specifically say, what is the solution? Because, again, winning the will of the people, it sounds great, and I wish it would work, but that, again, is a code word to me for nation building, and we're not going to do that.
Well, I think nation building has gotten an undeservedly bad reputation because people associated with the American invasion of Iraq. But most nation building is not and should not be done by hundreds of thousands of troops. Ed Lansdale was involved in nation building in the Philippines and South Vietnam in the early 1950s when it was just him and about a dozen associates. And they were doing it through friendship and empathy, winning over local leaders and advising them and trying to build up more effective and accountable governmental institutions. That's the kind of small-scale model of nation building that I think is very useful today. It's been used in places like Colombia and El Salvador relatively effectively. I think it's something we need to think about in the larger war on terror because we're not going to win the war on terror by sending hundreds of thousands of American troops to occupy the greater Middle East.
To Steve Cole was saying that the Bush administration was really opposed to nation building, but particularly when the Iraq War broke out, they pretty much tended to ignore, to a greater extent, Afghanistan, and it led to the kind of problems.
Right. And in fact, a lot of the problems we had in both Afghanistan and Iraq was that we came in, toppled the local governments, dissolved the armies, but then we didn't think about nation building, building up something that could control the territory in the future. And that led to these massive insurgencies that we're still dealing with.
Let me thank the caller, and we'll try to bring in more of your calls and remind you that our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, or our email address is simply forum@kqed.org. Here's Phil from San Mateo. Phil, you're on the air.
Hi. You know, one of the problems in all these countries is corruption, where, you know, for example, in Iraq, you know, the big army approach didn't work, and it was only when a new general was brought in that essentially dropped bribery money in at the top. And if you're going to win the hearts and minds of the people, you have to establish security. How do you do that in a horribly corrupt place where it's just this big web?
Well, I think the caller is right that corruption is a massive problem, and it's not a new issue. This was something that Ed Lansdale confronted in Vietnam in the 1960s when he tried to make the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, the South Vietnamese Army, more effective and less corrupt. And he tried to, in the practice of officers buying their posts and political favoritism, all these things that were eroding military effectiveness, and he had very little support from Washington. But those same issues have recurred in the present day in Afghanistan and Iraq, and we have paid far too little attention to them because we've just been focused on killing insurgents, and we've generally been happy to work with any military force that will fight alongside of us, and we choose to ignore how corrupt or abusive that force may be. But at the end of the day, that backfires on us because the number one recruiting agent for the Taliban in Afghanistan is the corruption and abusiveness of the government. So that's something we should have been paying much greater attention to than we have to date.
There's something in your book, Max, that suggests almost a kind of class division, the bureaucrats, the elitists, you know, and we were talking before about Robert McNamara in that vein, but there really is a sense that that Lansdale came out of a whole different kind of experience than these Harvard blue bloods that David Halberstam called the best and the brightest.
Well, he definitely was not one of the best and brightest. He was a middle-class kid who grew up in Detroit and in L.A. His family had a very up-and-down financial existence. He went to UCLA, dropped out, so he was not an Ivy Leaguer. He did not work on Wall Street. He had very, very much a different background. He was kind of a typical Californian, laid-back, unconventional. He was kind of a proto-Silicon Valley guy decades before Silicon Valley came into being. And so he brought that different perspective to military strategy and counterinsurgency. But it was often a hard sell with trying to convince the best and brightest, especially people like McNamara, who thought that all the problems of war and peace could be reduced to mathematical equations.
What do you see as really, when you think about works that encapsulate or get to the heart of the causes of the Vietnam War? And I won't include fiction here because I think there's been some great fiction by Tim O'Brien and Philip Caputo and people like that. But let's just talk about like Neil Sheehan's book, A Bright Shining Lie, or for that matter, the film of Ken Burns, which just was released not that long ago.
No, I mean, there's obviously a lot that's been written and a lot filmed about Vietnam, but I think what I've tried to do with this book is to find a new angle that has not been previously gone into.
You have, but I'm wondering if you think anybody has really up to this point captured a lot of what you're trying to get at here.
Well, not exactly what I'm trying to get at. I mean, there's a lot of value in books like Neil Sheehan's A Bright Shining Lie, and there was a book by Frederick Logoval called Embers of War about the French War in Indochina. So there have been a lot of good books, both fiction and nonfiction. But again, and Ed Lansdale has figured in many of them, but I think the characterizations of him have often been very shallow and not very accurate. And so I've tried to paint a fuller picture and used his life to try to tell a story of our involvement in the Vietnam War.
Here's a John who writes, pre-Lansdale, did the United States get mired in Vietnam to get France into NATO? Theodore White's book, In Search of History, states that the United States supplied planes, tanks, and ships to reoccupy French colonies and appease de Gaulle, thereby alienating the United States' World War II ally, Ho Chi Minh.
Well, the United States certainly backed the French war effort in Indochina from 1945 to 1954, primarily because we saw the French as a bulwark against communism in East Asia, but also because we did want French support in Europe for NATO and so forth. And so what happened was after the French lost to Dien Bien Phu in 1954 and Vietnam was divided, we essentially took over from the French as the anti-communist bulwarks. We became the sponsors of South Vietnam, and that's why Ed Lansdale was sent to Saigon in the summer of 1954 to create this new state of South Vietnam that would be backed primarily by the United States rather than by the French.
You're tough in this book on the Ivy Leaguers, as we said, on policymakers who have that pedigree, and also on a lot of the bureaucrats and generals like Westmoreland. Wondering also, you know, when I first picked up your book, I see a plug from General Petraeus. David Petraeus got some very strong plugs here. But, you know, there's some people who will just have to get you on record on this, who say Petraeus should have been prosecuted.
Prosecuted? I mean, I think what he did was a misdemeanor, and you know, there was no release of classified information. I think he remains one of the most important American generals of the post-World War II period, and I think tremendously accomplished in the case of Iraq in 2007, 2008, the surge, which was really an application of Lansdalean-type thinking to the situation in Iraq, really trying to implement counterinsurgency strategy instead of just killing insurgents, and that showed a lot of success, even though it was eventually squandered by lack of follow-up.
But his woman friend, his mistress, I don't know what word is current these days, you know, he was essentially communicating with her. It wasn't all that different than what Hillary Clinton was being charged with in terms of accessibility. And
I respectfully disagree. I mean, his woman friend, Paula Broderick, was actually a military officer who had
and
a security—
And she was his biographer, right?
And she had a security clearance. And he did share some information with her, but it was never publicly released, and there was no compromise of American security as a result of that.
Let me bring some more callers aboard here, and we go to you. Yaya, good morning.
Hey, good morning. How you doing? My question is, or my comment, I should say, what does your guest think about the fact that the military complex is not really interested in how many of our own American soldiers are dying or get killed or maimed, or even the people that they're fighting against, as long as it profits the military establishment to sell more war planes, et cetera, et cetera? And does he think that that is the primary interest of war after war after war?
Well, I disagree with that. I don't think it's accurate to say that there's a quote-unquote military complex that doesn't care about how many of our troops get killed. We're actually very sensitive to casualties and try to minimize casualties on our side to the greatest extent possible. I think it's more accurate to say, perhaps, that we don't care so much about how many other people get killed, non-American troops, and we do have a tendency to use firepower rather freely, especially in the case of Vietnam, but to some extent even in more recent days. And that's something that Ed Lansdale warned against, because he consistently said that if you kill too many innocent people, you're going to create more enemies than you eliminate. So I think that is something that we need to keep in mind.
Let me thank the caller and go to a comment of Bill's, who says, one thing seldom mentioned regarding the Vietnam War is the number of American casualties brokered by Henry Kissinger to prolong peace talks until after Nixon got into office so he could take credit. How many lives would have been saved if Diem brokered peace with Lyndon Johnson was president, while Johnson was president?
Well, that's a complex issue. In 1968, when Nixon was running for president, we now know that he was involved in secret machinations with Nguyen Van Thieu, the president of South Vietnam, to sabotage Lyndon Johnson's attempts to start peace talks with North Vietnam, because he thought that if those peace talks started, it would help Hubert Humphrey. And that was shameful and wrong, but I would not necessarily conclude that peace talks would have been successful in 1968 unless we were willing to give up a lot of what the U.S. government was asking for at that point, and I don't know that we would have been. So this was, you know, what Nixon did was wrong, but I wouldn't necessarily conclude that peace would have been so easy to achieve if not for his interference.
Of course, there are some who would argue that Diem was a bad actor and that there were many bad actors on the South Vietnamese side. General Key comes quickly to mind, for example. Could we have, in other words, won those hearts and minds? Would that have been to our advantage?
Well, I think the turning point in our involvement in Vietnam was the overthrow of Ngo Dinh Diem in 1963, because in Lansdale's estimation, he was the least bad alternative out there. He was the only leader in South Vietnam who had legitimacy as both an anti-colonialist and an anti-communist. He was not personally corrupt. He was somewhat autocratic. But Lansdale consistently argued that the people who replaced him would be worse, and he was completely vindicated, because you had military coup following military coup. And so I begin the book with the Diem coup, because I think that was the last chance to avoid Americanizing the conflict.
We'll bring more of your calls on. Let me go next to you, Decker. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
I'm curious. With American involvement in military escapades during the 20th century, including the Great Wars, do you see a correlation between success and failure in relation to how much the military-industrial complex is regulated by the government during the wartime ramp-up?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by the military-industrial complex regulated by the government. What do you mean by that?
Well, for instance, during World War II, there were active government agencies that helped police what war materials were being produced when they rapidly turned over a lot of factories from civilian use to military. During every war or military conflict where we end up using a lot of munitions, we increase the amount of purchase of the military munitions, and we don't always increase the oversight of the quality and of the increased quantity.
Okay, I get what you're saying, and what you're referring to in World War II is the fact that we really federalized a huge part of the economy in order to wage total war and to provide the materiel to defeat Germany and Japan, and we haven't done that since. But I don't think it has much relation to victory or defeat. I would not blame arms manufacturers on our lack of success in conflicts. I think a lot of it, to the extent that we have a lack of success, it's because we're paying more attention to firepower, not politics. But again, that's not driven by the arms makers. That's driven by the imperatives of the Washington process, and also because we often lack staying power. And a lot of the reason why we won World War II was we stuck around afterwards and transformed Germany, Italy, and Japan from enemies into friends. And in places like Vietnam or Somalia or many other places, Iraq after 2011, where we've pulled out, we've often squandered whatever gains we might have won on the battlefield.
Decker, if you want to respond.
I just wanted to say thank you for answering the question. I do want to point out that in Iraq in the early 2000s under George Bush, we had absolutely no government control. It's just a slap on the wrist and a fine if anything was found wrong. And we certainly didn't seem to be very successful. Although, to your point, I totally agree that if we had the staying power in Iraq and stayed longer to rebuild instead of just military police it, we would have had much more success.
Okay. Thank you for the call. Of course, in some ways, what went on in Iraq after the war was even as disastrous as the war itself. Probably did lead to ISIS, didn't it?
Well, I think the fact that we pulled out in 2011 created the opportunity for ISIS to arise. We had a chance to solidify our gains, and instead, I think we grew complacent and pulled out, and the results were obviously catastrophic.
Let me go to more of your calls, and let's go next to Tom. Tom, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
How would you compare your Mr. Lansdale to Alan Dulles? We just had a wonderful book by David Talbert, The Devil's Chessboard. How would you compare the differences between these two characters?
Well, Ed Lansdale was a great favorite of Alan Dulles. He worked for Alan Dulles in the Philippines and in Vietnam in the 1950s, and Dulles really championed him such that...
You should mention Alan Dulles was head of the CIA.
Right, such that even when Lansdale came into conflict with local ambassadors, even a four-star ambassador in Saigon, General Lightning Joe Collins, the support of Alan Dulles and his brother, John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State, allowed Ed Lansdale to override these local leaders and to impose his own will. The reason why Dulles liked Lansdale and why President Eisenhower liked Lansdale was because they wanted to avoid these massive American military interventions, but they still wanted to achieve American security aims of trying to stymie what they saw as a communist onslaught. And so the work of people like Ed Lansdale allowed them to achieve their objectives at very low cost, because instead of sending multiple army divisions, they could just send Ed Lansdale with a dozen associates and they could work in secret to buttress local capabilities to defeat the communists, which is something that he did most successfully in the Philippines and then tried to do again in Vietnam.
You read David Talbot's book?
I have not.
Well, Dulles comes off pretty badly, to put it mildly. Recommend it. It is a good book, like the listener said. Very good book. We featured it here on Forum. John writes, would Lansdale have preferred to accept a communist Vietnam rather than continue America's military involvement there? Would Max Boot be willing to accept a Taliban-ruled Afghanistan rather than continuing America's military involvement there? People would rather be ruled by their own monsters than by foreigners, no matter how competent and well-intentioned.
Well, in both cases, there's no evidence that the people of South Vietnam wanted to be ruled by communists or that the people of Afghanistan want to be ruled by the Taliban. In fact,
there's more evidence of the opposite.
More evidence of the opposite. In fact, the Taliban have the support of fewer than 10% of the people of Afghanistan in polls. And if you think about all those people living in cities, the women, everybody who would be oppressed and in many cases murdered by the Taliban, that's the last thing in the world they want. And remember, in the case of South Vietnam, there was never a popular communist uprising. The communists ultimately won with an armored invasion in 1975. It wasn't that the people of South Vietnam welcomed them with open arms. But, you know, what Ed Lansdale observed in the 60s was that the people of South Vietnam really just wanted to be left alone. They didn't want to be ruled by the communists, but they didn't want to be in the middle of this bloody war that we were waging either. They just wanted to be left alone. And he was trying to help the people of South Vietnam to have a government that would be responsive to their wishes. But this was not the agenda of the day in Washington.
Max Boot is our guest. His book is A Road Not Taken, Edward Lansdale and the American Tragedy in Vietnam, and he'll be at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco today at 6:30. And Mari writes, it's interesting that you continue to contrast Lansdale with the best and the brightest. He is the prototype of the true genius, someone who is a dropout not because they can't handle university-level academics, but because his intellectual thirst was not quenched. He was able to see things in ways that others could not.
Well, I think that's true.
And here's another caller. Let me have Patrick join us. Patrick, you're on.
How do you? Thank you for the show. And I just want to ask your guest, concerning the surge and General Petraeus, is there any truth in the idea that there was no real surge? All we did was send 30,000 troops over there who all of them stood down, and that American casualties went very, very low, and it looked like a successful operation, but nothing really happened. Is there any truth to that?
No, that's not true. In fact, The surge, you're right, it wasn't primarily a surge of personnel, although we did increase 30,000 troops, but it was really, as General Petraeus says, a surge of ideas. It was moving U.S. troops out of these giant bases into the population centers, and it was also crucially working on Lansdale-type political action, trying to reconcile the Sunnis and the Shia, bringing them closer together, flipping the Sunni tribes from al-Qaeda to the side of the government. And as a result of all of that, violence between 2007 and 2009 declined by over 90% in Iraq. So this was a substantial achievement, even though it did not prove enduring.
Let me thank the caller. And Brian says, so I don't think I heard you say this, but he said, so Max Boot thinks Eisenhower's warning about the military-industrial complex was not prescient?
Well, that's a separate issue. I mean, I think that you know, President Eisenhower had good points about the way that arms manufacturers working with Congress and the Pentagon distort our budget priorities. But I think you're going over the top if you're claiming that all the problems we have in waging war are due to arms manufacturers. I think it's really due to misbegotten thinking in these various administrations and in the military.
Max Boot, good to have you with us again on Forum. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be back. Always a good conversation.
And Max Boot, again, is now a columnist for the Washington Post and senior fellow for National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. His book, again, is A Road Not Taken, Edward Lansdale and the American Tragedy in Vietnam. And he'll be at the Commonwealth Club today at 6:30. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. I should say that today actually marks 25 years behind this microphone for me. That's a milestone. Time fleeting and ephemerality come to mind, but so does the fact that it is a milestone, and so does the fact that whatever we do here is a shared effort, and there is a great team behind all the programs that you hear. Our producers are Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, Susan Britton, and Katie Sprenger. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Engineer today is Steve Asrigadu. Engagement producer Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Lisa Arbatman and Ali Wollner. Managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. Executive producer is Holly Kernan. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.